morning, Professor.
I'd like to ask, for you, how would you define climate change?
How would I define climate change?
Yeah.
Well, I think the most important way to look at climate change is to look at the structure that defines the overall dynamics of the atmosphere and how that couples into a combination of weather, severe storms, changes in the ice structures, shifts in the temperature difference between the tropics and the polar regions. So the climate is set up as a feedback structure that is highly coupled, so that changes in one part, for example, loss of Arctic ice, cascades into a whole array of different fundamental changes in the structure of climate. For example, right now the current climate structure is built around a very cold polar region and a very warm tropics, and because of that we have a very, very dry stratosphere, and that's a unique climate structure. If we lose Arctic ice and the temperature difference starts to decrease between the tropics and the polar regions, the overturning structure of the atmosphere will relax and water will enter the stratosphere. We'll have a very warm, very wet stratosphere, and the result of that is that the temperature difference between the equator and the pole will essentially vanish. And that completely changes the way the climate structure of the Earth behaves. But more than that, with a moist stratosphere, ozone is removed from the stratosphere because we have chlorine and bromine that are present there because of CFC release. And so that's going to be profoundly damaging to life on the surface, not just human beings, but also all of our staple crops that provide food for the population. All of that will collapse. So I view climate as an issue of the structure, not simply a matter of global warming. I think the term global warming is a very inappropriate description. It carries with it the connotation of very slow change and the fact that we can think things over. But instead of that, climate is a series of irreversible steps. The time constant for change is set by these feedbacks. And so it's a very delicate, very intricate structure that we've been bequeathed by the optimal relationship between the cold polar region and the warm tropics.
In terms of the climate change, we've always had these debates, right, regarding if climate change is caused by humans or is it caused by nature. But most people think the scientific consensus stands on that global warming and climate change is caused by humans. Where do you stand on this matter?
Well, when you look at the changes in climate over the past millions of years, it's very evident that there were mechanisms in place that caused those natural changes, whether it was a volcanic emission of CO2, whether it was the removal of CO2 from the atmosphere by the carbonate silicate reactions, or whether it was the Earth's orbit eccentricity and the tilt of the Earth in combination that carried us in and out of glacial periods for the past 2.5 million years. When you look at these patterns, they are all overwhelmed by increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It's a very simple calculation. And so the idea that what we've seen recently is a natural process decoupled from human activity is simply false. Humans are overwhelmingly responsible for causing the forcing of the climate that's now taking place, that slowly manifests itself in average global temperature change, but dramatically emphasizes the point that the delicacy of the climate structure revolves first around the removal of ice structures, particularly in the Arctic, And so there's no question that human beings are fundamentally responsible for the current changes in the climate.
So do you think climate change is drastically affecting you?
Well, it's drastically affecting me in that I study it, and my concern grows year by year as I study the system more and more carefully and study the feedbacks that lead to tipping points, which are irreversible changes. So it has a huge impact on my life. With respect to my analysis of personal impacts by climate change alone, part of our research focuses on the intensity and frequency of severe storms in the high plains of the United States in the summer. These are tornadoes, hail storms that we tend to take for granted in this country, but are in fact unique worldwide. And the reason that these storms are important, first of all, is of course they are profoundly destructive to human life and human property. But more importantly, they're capable of injecting water directly into the stratosphere over the United States in the summer. And we diagnosed the chemistry over the Antarctic and the Arctic in the winter that led to the Antarctic ozone hole and then comparable large removal of ozone over the Arctic in the late winter. And diagnosing that chemistry, we realized that it's exactly the same chemistry that's triggered by storms injecting water vapor into the stratosphere, except in this case it's over the United States in the summer rather than the polar regions in the winter. So absolutely. Now of course the jet stream position is a sensitive function of the temperature difference between the tropics and the polar regions, and that jet stream position of course brought one of the largest snowfalls to New England. So yeah, I shoveled out day after day after day, and if we had a disciplined temperature structure between the tropics and the polar regions, the meandering of that jet stream would not have occurred the way it did. So, yes.
So, we know that many institutions these days spend so much money on trying to combat global warming. There are many non-profit organizations, but do you think the money being spent is actually making a difference, because we see that global warming is still a very big issue?
Okay, first of all, of course, based on what I've said so far, the term global warming is an inappropriate term to describe climate change. And I think one of the reasons that the entire campaign around climate change has been ineffective was that, and scientists are at fault for this, the term global warming was used, and it carries with it no political imperative, because many people want their backyard to be warmer. They're moving out of New England and the northern Midwest and moving south. So it has no political impetus behind it, and it has this connotation of slow change. So if I compare the resources going into describing climate change and its irreversible consequences versus the money that's going in from the fossil fuel industry distributing misinformation about this subject, there's no parity between those two. Massively more money is being spent on misinformation from the fossil fuel industry than is being spent on representing the facts related to climate change. Now, I also hold universities culpable because they're not educating their undergraduates on the fundamentals of what's actually occurring in the climate energy axis. And until universities step up and take responsibility for modern curricula that prepare their graduates to take a proactive role in society, it's going to be very difficult to make political progress, because the money invested in by the fossil fuel industry and misinformation largely overwhelms efforts to try to explain this to the public.
Do you think climate change is now more to a political issue or a scientific issue? Because these days we see that it has shifted a lot to politics, because the Democrats and Republicans are asked to take sides on whether they support climate change or they shouldn't.
Yeah, well, it's overwhelmingly an issue of political will, but you're absolutely correct in bringing in three elements of this: politics, science, and economics. And as the situation is examined more and more carefully, it's pretty clear that economics is switching strongly over for renewable energy, because, to put it bluntly, middle-aged and older people are making money off of fossil fuels, and that blocks opportunity for young people to engage in innovation, creativity, and economic enterprise globally. But the investment in renewables and the job opportunities presented by renewable energy vastly overwhelm the job opportunities in fossil fuels. And in fact, you can see it occurring. There are major investments by companies, Google, for example, is just one, but many others, investing in renewable energy and renewable energy infrastructure. And the country that wins this battle on innovation and development of renewable energy sources, wind, solar, geothermal, that become economically competitive worldwide, will be the country or countries that win the economic battle, because there's vastly greater opportunity and capability for the next generation embedded in the renewable energy sector than there is in fossil fuels. Fossil fuels is a dead industry. It doesn't generate jobs in anything close to the number of the potential within the renewable energy industry.
So, are you familiar with the Kyoto Protocol?
Oh, yes.
Do you think it would actually be beneficial for U.S. if it actually joined the Kyoto Protocol, because it did withdraw from the Kyoto Protocol, right?
Right, well, starting with another protocol, we did the key research over the Antarctic demonstrating that COCs destroyed ozone, in particular the chlorine and bromine radicals. And so we were involved in the public policy debates around the Montreal Protocol, which then became an international agreement banning CFCs. So I've watched the evolution of these protocols very carefully. The Kyoto Protocol had on its side the advantage that it brought nations together to try to execute an international agreement on fossil fuels. Now, it failed in many ways. One of them was that it probably didn't recognize the rapid ascent of the Asian economic structure. And secondly, you can watch very carefully to see whether there'll be any serious negotiation over carbon release, namely CO2 and methane, by whether nations actually have a highly unequivocal budget of their own carbon release and take up. Because all of these countries are very, very different. The United States, for example, because it was an agricultural endeavor on the eastern end of the United States in the 19th and early 20th century, it actually was taking up quite a bit of carbon because it was regrowing these forests that were cleared for farming. But every nation is different, and every nation has to have a very detailed definition of the flux of carbon into and out of its own territory. So the Kyoto Protocol didn't have that basic information in place, so it couldn't in any way be an effective international governance. On the other hand, it opened the debate about nations signing on to carbon control. So from that point of view, it was a landmark event. It just had some fatal flaws in it, which could have been repaired in time had countries stepped in to take advantage of it. And that gets back to the fundamental point that until China, the United States, Western Europe, Japan, and Korea, and perhaps Brazil, sign on to a carbon control agreement, it won't take place. So you know, meetings involving 190 nations are simply never going to solve the problem. It has to be solved with China and the United States signing an agreement, having clear controls, and then Western Europe, Korea, and Japan signing on to those agreements.
There has been theories regarding why climate change has happened. For example, like that there's a change in the ozone layer. Do you think that it really plays a big factor, the change in the ozone layer, in terms of how the climate is changing?
No, the ozone layer doesn't control climate. Climate controls the ozone layer. It works the other way around. Ozone controls this lethal small segment of the spectrum, the ultraviolet spectrum, which just barely penetrates the stratospheric ozone, because ozone is the only molecule that removes ultraviolet photons between 200 and 300 nanometers, which is exactly where DNA absorbs ultraviolet photons. And an ultraviolet photon absorbed by DNA breaks the base pair across the double helix and it initiates cancer. So ozone is extremely rare. If you compress the total ozone column from the stratosphere to the floor of this office, it would only be an eighth of an inch thick. So tiny, tiny amount of ozone. It has dominant control, total control over that crucial segment of the ultraviolet spectrum that kills organisms on the surface and initiates cancer. But ozone doesn't control the climate. On the other hand, climate intimately controls ozone, because climate controls the amount of water going into the stratosphere, and the amount of water in the stratosphere decidedly controls the ozone concentration.
Well, there has been a lot of speculations regarding how humans try to control greenhouse gases from getting too bad. Why do you think humans have failed to actually like curb the greenhouse gases, to control them?
Oh, because the entire economic infrastructure is built on the back of cheap energy, namely fossil fuels. And fossil fuels are abundant, they're very inexpensive, and yet they are responsible for 85% of all primary energy generation worldwide. So we built fossil fuels into our economic structure. However, I think Mother Nature is sitting back and watching this process, saying, well, I gave humans the intelligence to know how to extract an amount of fossil fuels to initiate the Industrial Revolution. But I've also given human beings 10,000 times as much energy per unit time from the sun as is required to sustain all of human endeavor. So now I'm going to see whether humans are smart enough to convert from fossil fuel to renewable energy, because I've given them all the renewable energy they could possibly hope for. And so it's going to be a question of political will and fundamental intelligence about whether we can break the back of a needless economic infrastructure based on fossil fuels that not only causes climate change, but the release of nitrate, sulfate, heavy metal from coal combustion in particular is extremely toxic. I mean, look at China today, look at the United States 30 years ago. Nitrate sulfate emission is a catastrophic contribution to acidity in the atmosphere and damages lakes, human lungs, and then mercury that's interstitial to coal is very damaging to the human nervous system. So everything is wrong with burning fossil fuels. Everything is correct in converting photons from the sun to electricity. And that leaves you with only 7% of the requirement for liquid fuels, and we can create all the liquid fuel we need for aviation from biomass. So nature set this whole system up ideally for us. The question is, are we smart enough to figure this out?
Do you think that humans can switch to renewable energy in the near future, though? Because people do have some technology, such as solar-powered cars, but when they do try to invent that, they later on found out that it would quite big, costly to be used in the near future because it's prices.
For what? For automobiles are you talking about?
For example, automobiles, yeah, because a lot of renewable energy are quite costly to implement in the near future.
Do you mean the generation of the power or the use of it in an automobile?
The use of it in daily applications.
Okay, let's take an automobile. I drive an electric car, for example, and the first thing you discover when you drive an electric car is that they're profoundly better systems than a gasoline-powered automobile. They are quiet, they accelerate very, very quickly, they're very agile, they're very simple to drive, and they it costs you typically for a standard gasoline-powered car, it costs you about $2,500 a year for the average driving distance to fuel that car for a year. It costs you $250 for the electricity to go the same distance. So immediately, if humans test electric cars, are going to switch over to them. Now, it's true the technology for the range of the electric car is evolving. The Tesla Model S, for example, goes 280 miles on a charge. The particular car I drive goes about 100 miles on a charge, but it has a range extender for another 80 miles or so. So the cost is actually far less to propel the system through electricity than it is through buying gasoline. And the same is true of heating and cooling buildings. A heat pump is more than twice as efficient as burning fossil fuels in your basement to heat your house, because the heat pump uses the intrinsic heat or energy in an air mass and only adds a small amount of that to warm your house. And this can be done thermodynamically very, very efficiently. So when you look at the laws of thermodynamics, you see that electricity, heat pumps, electric motors are vastly more efficient and less expensive than heat engines. Heat engines, for example, in your car only convert about 12 to 13% of the chemical energy in gasoline into motive force. So if you look at the laws of physics and you look at the economic pathways forward, you see that electrification of these systems is by far the most efficient, cost-effective way. And that doesn't include all the damage done to the environment and to climate by the effluents coming from fossil fuel combustion.
Do you think your experiences working here and around the Boston area has affected how you think about climate change?
Well, the immediate answer to that question is that I'm in chemistry, chemical biology department, earth and planetary sciences department, and the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences at Harvard. So this is a profoundly rich mixture of colleagues who understand these issues end to end. And then there's the Harvard University Center for the Environment that couples science into the Kennedy School, Law School, Business School, Medical School, School of Public Health. And the way in which that links into economics and politics and joins science, economics, and politics together is a really unique opportunity. So there's that aspect to it. And then when you live on the coast, you realize that sea level rise, which is inexorably coming from the melting of glacial systems, particularly in Greenland and the West Antarctic ice shelf, you realize how vulnerable coastal cities are. And Harvard is investing billions of dollars to build a new campus just across the Charles River that's only a meter and a half above sea level. Well, the nominal forecast for sea level rise by the end of the century, only a quarter of the length of time Harvard has been a university, is somewhere between 2 and 3 meters with a tail running out to 6 to 7 meters. So immediately building in Alston raises the question, well, what's going to happen when sea level rises and those buildings start to go underwater? So yeah, Boston is a fantastic place to study climate.
So many scientists have tried to find a way to measure change in climate change, but one of the most notable, I think, is that they suggested to try to use an average global temperature to measure the change. Do you think this is a correct way to measure?
No, I think it's the least articulate way of studying what's occurring, because when you look at global mean temperature, what the dominant control over global mean temperature involves the inflow of heat into the ocean and into the land mass and into the ice systems. Well, the oceans cover 70% of the area of the Earth, and they have an average depth of 3,500 meters, and they have massive heat capacity, the oceans, that is. So a lot of heat can pour into the ocean before there's any measurable temperature change. The thing you have to look at is the measure of the flow of heat into, for example, the ice structures, the cryospheric system, and you realize that tiny, tiny amount of inflow of heat can completely destroy the ice systems, because the heat of fusion of water is so small that all of these ice systems are profoundly delicate. And so defining this in terms of the increase in global mean temperature is the worst way to describe the severity of the problem.
So for yourself, what do you think is the best thing to do to prevent global warming for now?
Well, they're actually, when you look at the numbers on the rate of onset of, for example, the loss of ice systems in the Arctic, you look at the paleo record, where you track the relationship between ice systems, global climate structure, temperature, and carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere from, say, the Eocene 40 million years ago, you come to the very immediate quantitative conclusion that three things are going to be necessary. We have to terminate adding more CO2 to the atmosphere, because we're now at 400 parts per million of CO2, but we have to add another 90 parts per million from the combination of methane, N2O, and CFCs. So we're at almost 500 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. At 500 parts per million of CO2, the paleo record shows that there are no ice structures in the northern hemisphere at that level. And when you destroy the ice structures in the northern hemisphere, you destroy the temperature difference between the equator and the pole that drives the fundamental climate structure. So that tells you immediately that you have to do three things. You have to stop adding CO2 to the atmosphere and methane and N2O immediately. You have to draw CO2 back down below 300 parts per million to reach a stable state. And then you have to cool the planet to reform those ice structures. And you have to do that very, very gently. But all three of those are required. And that's just an unfortunate fact.
So how would you convince people to believe that we are causing global warming? Because many people are still debating over this, and like households, well, people do say some stuff like, don't you want a better world for your grandchildren? But I think when we look back at what people think about this, I think they collectively say something like, we just want to enjoy this time for ourselves. Let the next generation figure out itself. But it's also a fact that through a poll, it's like one out of four Americans are skeptical towards global warming. So what do you think about this?
Well, first of all, I think this is always an issue about generational investment for the next generation. That's just human nature, and it's a very important point that you make. That a lot of people would say, well, look, rather than making an intelligent decision to switch to solar renewables and wean ourselves off of fossil fuels, let's just continue to burn fossil fuels and create instabilities for not just our grandchildren, but for our children, because the U.S. military is a very important organization to look at. They deem climate change as equally destabilizing as nuclear armaments. And so that determines the seriousness of the problem, because the military has to be responsible quite often, ultimately, for political instability worldwide. We always move in with the military, sometimes effectively, sometimes not. So there's that aspect to it. But that brings us back to the question of the degree of irrefutability of the information that we have on climate change. And here is where two institutions have failed us. One is the government strategic structure for analyzing the physics and chemistry of climate change, because there are many, many observations that are required that will profoundly point out how serious the problem is and how rapidly things are changing. For example, we have limited ocean observations of the flow of heat in underneath the Arctic ice cap, the West Antarctic ice shelf. We have very limited observations about the coupling of severe storms into the stratosphere to destroy ozone. We don't understand the physics of deep convective storms that generates this convective injection that is responsible for very intense storms over the United States. We have no forecasts of drought. We don't know if the California drought is going to last 2 years, 20 years, 200 years, or 2,000 years. We simply don't have the forecasts. We don't have a forecast of sea level rise that's trusted. So we have a huge breakdown in the viability of our research structure related to defining quantitatively climate change. And until we make even a modest investment in that, we'll never have the information. The second aspect, the second institution that's culpable, are the universities, for the point I made before. The curricula in universities across the country, and there are 2 million students that graduate from U.S. universities each year, they walk away the morning of their graduation with a diploma without the faintest idea what the fundamental facts are in the linkage between climate and energy generation. And so they're susceptible to misinformation by the fossil fuel industry. If you watch a presidential primary debate and you know the facts around energy and climate, you're shocked by the completely fallacious answers that come out of presidential candidates' mouths. And ostensibly, this is run by a journalistic institution that is organizing the debate. But the journalists involved in this don't know the facts themselves to call the candidates on misinformation. So the government and the federal research structure has to step up and deal with the scope and the scale of climate change through a research program that's actually capable of diagnosing specifically what's going on. And the universities have to step up and develop curricula that produces knowledge in those graduates, 2 million a year, that allows them to make clear, concise judgments about the future. And of course, those students have a couple of parents, so when they come home in the middle of term and the parents say, well, what did you learn this term for my $40,000, those students can come back and they can say, well, I understand this about climate structure and I understand that about primary energy generation, and these are facts that need to be acted on. So in fact, it's 6 million people a year affected by a good university curriculum, and 10 times 6, that's 60 million people in a decade. Universities have to step up and take responsibility for that.
So how vulnerable do you think we are towards climate change right now?
Well, we're profoundly vulnerable. Look at what's happening in California, and look what's happening in the Northwest. The Columbia River Basin has less snowpack this year than any time in recorded history. The frequency and intensity of severe storms that sets in April and runs all the way through August, that creates a belt from Oklahoma to Wisconsin for severe storms that's doing terrible damage. The frequency and intensity are increasing. Sea level rise is is increasing, but so too are severe storms that bring storm surges to the coast. If you look at Norfolk, Virginia, for example, which is a major naval base, it's now under serious duress in rising water. The entire southern third of Florida goes underwater with just a 3 meter sea level rise. So I think we have a profound problem because all of this is irreversible. We can't just stop adding CO2 to the atmosphere. We've already loaded it to the degree where these events are inexorable.
So the final question that I would like to bring up is that do you think that climate change in an overall scale is still a debatable topic?
No, only amongst the uninformed. It's only viewed as a debatable topic because of the misinformation that's pumped into the system by the fossil fuel industry. I mean, not only do they spend billions of dollars on misinformation, they support candidates who deny climate change, and that keeps the debate open. It's very similar to what happened during the tobacco smoking lung cancer era in this country, where the tobacco industry did everything it could to cast doubt on the relationship between smoking and lung cancer. And it delayed action on cigarette smoking by decades. And it's, in fact, Naomi Oreskes has demonstrated in her book, Merchants of Doubt, that not only are the same tactics being applied to climate denial, but the same people are at the center of developing that strategy to inject misinformation into the system. So it appears to be a debate, when in fact it's not a debate.
Okay.
Okay?
All right. Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome.